You're listening to WAER News at WAER.org and NPR One.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik makes a trip to Syracuse Monday, October 15th. He's also now hosting On Point, which can be heard each weekday morning at 10 here on WAER. I had a chance to speak with Folkenflik about his beat, the new role as program host, and his views on coverage of issues from politics and the White House to big entertainment mergers, the effect of reporting on sexual harassment, and the shift from watching to streaming. David Folkenflik, NPR media correspondent and host of On Point. Thanks for talking with us here at WAER.
Great to join you.
First of all, how did you come to the topic and beat of being a media correspondent? Did you like the business of it, the social impact appeal to you, or entertainment stuff? You know, what appealed to you about becoming a media correspondent as a beat?
So I first started covering media in 2000 for the Baltimore Sun. I had just come off a stint of several years in the Washington Bureau for the Sun. Back when the Sun had a pretty live and boisterous Washington bureau, and I had covered the Clinton impeachment in Congress and a whole host of issues, mostly looking at it through the prism of Congress and various governmental agencies and how it affected people in Maryland and the country more broadly. In figuring out what to do next, an editor said, "Hey, you might cover TV," and I said, "Maybe make it about media." He said, "Maybe make it about business." And I said, "Why not widen the focus so that I can do stuff on the business and the journalism of media?" Because it seemed to me as though in some ways it was a way to look at society through a slightly different prism. And it was also a way to look at these really influential organizations and institutions that make up the media and hold them accountable and to understand how they operated and how they interacted with a lot of these forces in politics and commerce and everything else. So it seemed to me to be a pretty substantive beat that had often been covered pretty much lightly, as though it were just a beat about celebrity or a beat about who's got ratings or a beat about who's embarrassed somebody else. And in fact, while I'm really interested in talking about some of the business issues, I'm very interested in the way in which it affects people's lives. And I'm interested in the entertainment side, too. God knows I'm a consumer of this stuff.
Well, yeah. And as an institution, media is quite pervasive in just all parts of our lives. You know, it influences a lot. I mean, I guess in the news sense, it might not be seen as a topic area to cover, such as, say, politics or the economy or education or something.
I think it's increasingly at the center stage of where we look now, particularly in the current political era we're in. And in the way in which technology has taken us over, it's really allowed people and at times almost compelled people to absorb media far more than ever. But, you know, as a business beat, as a beat about politics and citizenship, as a beat about entertainment, it seemed to me that media could be awfully substantive and awfully interesting. And when in roughly 2004, NPR set off on converting a pretty significant gift into, among other things, some a series of major new senior reporting jobs, I leapt at the chance to be considered for this, to do it for NPR, and I've been doing it here ever since.
And how are you liking the new role? On Point is a program we have on WAER at 10 a.m. every morning. How are you liking that role as a host, getting to talk to people and about a lot of different things, a little bit different than a beat reporter?
It's enormous fun. It's real work, and it's really enjoyable. It's an opportunity to flex different muscles. I have to think harder, more immediately, and on a broader range of issues than ever before. And, you know, you go from one week to talk to John Kerry, next week to talk to Tom Hanks, do, you know, another hour on gun violence, talk to the comic actor Ellie Kemper. You know, there's a variety of different kinds of personalities and policies and issues and a variety of ways of exploring the human experience that I'm really enjoying very much. I'm still new, and I'm still racing to hit my full stride. But it's a lot of fun to do, and I appreciate listeners coming along for the ride.
Well, and plus there's the aspect of it is a conversational program, not only with the guests but with listeners, et cetera. Certainly that's one of the appeal to listeners of the program.
And I love it. I don't know necessarily where they're going to go. It sometimes springboards great great questions that I might not have thought of or sharpens the conversation. I got to tell you, a few weeks ago when I interviewed John Kerry about his memoir, and whatever you think about him, he's led an extraordinarily substantive life. He started to get calls from a number of people who had been veterans, some of them in Vietnam, some of them more recently, and they talked a bit about their service. And he really, you could hear him open up, and you could hear, you know, he's a fairly formal guy. John Kerry, former senator, former secretary of state. But you could hear him open up, and he started to, when I talked to him about what it was like during the 2004 presidential bid, when he was what's called swift-boated, which is to say attacked groundlessly and accused of doing things, essentially war crimes that he didn't do, he started to really describe very immediately what a certain combat incident was like from his perspective, from his vantage point, in a way where it almost took you there cinematically. And he may have done it before, but I'd never heard him do it before. And it was a very human moment that I think was really occasioned and prompted by kind of calls he got from listeners during the show. And to me, it was just one of many examples of the power of having people involved in a conversation rather than simply listening and aloof from it.
Yeah, right. That sounds like a great anecdote. Getting to media coverage, you know, it's pretty hard to ignore coverage of Washington and the White House, as well as the calling out of the news media by the president so often. You interviewed Major Garrett recently, the CBS correspondent, a few weeks back. You asked him how well has the press covered the president. Of course, you were looking for his opinion. We're looking for yours. What would be your assessment of that same question?
Well, like him, to be fair, the media encompasses so many different kinds of actors, some of them acting in good faith, some of them not, some of them better than others, some of them stronger and bigger than others, that it's almost too much to encompass. But I think there's been some brilliant and intense and wonderful accountability journalism that has needed to be done about this administration, not because the press is hostile to this administration, but because this administration effectively launched a sense of crisis around the country when it took over that wasn't particularly grounded in economic crisis, wasn't grounded in any new war. There wasn't any attack on us, but there was the sense that the government was being pulled apart by policies for which neither the public nor the administration itself were really prepared to put in place or justify. And it also was accompanied by a real clenching and reaction against ideas of transparency that I think journalists can hold dear regardless of who's in office, and ideas of there's almost no better way to say it, but there's a shamelessness about being held to account. That is that this administration, all administrations spin. Many administrations have lied, but most of them are shamed by the exposure of those of truths that contradict their statements. And this administration has proven almost immune from that. So journalists have to rely upon not some semblance of order to be brought by their reporting, but they have to rely on their own reporting to get through to the American public, and they have to do even more work to ensure that the information they're providing the public is accurate and true. And so I think there's been a lot of good work done. At the same time, I think there's been plenty of hyperventilation. I think there's been a lot of coverage, and this I think is particularly true to newer online sites and cable news and television news more generally, but not exclusively limited to them. There's been a lot of focus on the president's rhetoric, a lot of coverage that is sent in this direction or that direction by a tweet from the White House, you know, really chasing the ball rather than figuring out the lay of the land on its own terms. So you've seen, you know, in recent days, you've seen coverage like the New York Times doing an incredibly intensive, comprehensive, and deep dive into the president's taxes. And through those taxes and the documents they've been able to obtain over the last 18 months, they're able to really create a full portrait of not only the president's tax situations, but really the president's net worth, the president's the disparity between the president's long, long sculpted image as a self-made billionaire from the idea that he wasn't self-made and he probably wasn't a billionaire either. I think it's been an enormous and valuable service. I will say that's the kind of reporting you would expect the New York Times and other major news outlets to have done on the president before he took office and even during the primary season. And while there may have been reasons why that wasn't possible, I think it's It is certainly to the discredit of the press that it wasn't able to achieve that at a time when voters were evaluating the president. But here he is in office, and I think it's an incredible tour de force of reporting if you read it all the way through.
I mean, some media outlets, I guess I'm thinking of the Washington Post and others, almost made a conscious pivot to be, as you described, accountability police, if you will, on the White House, because so much was challengeable and maybe sometimes very easily fact-checked to be false or something. Do you think that kind of thing, especially from such a major media organization and others, has been helpful, or is it almost maybe even been polarizing a little bit?
I mean, the funny thing is the Post has been a little bit less there's been a less bravado with the Post, I'd say, than with the New York Times in performing that same role. And I wouldn't say that the accountability is a pivot for the Post. If you think about its role over the decades, was one of the main papers on the Pentagon Papers, as commemorated in the recent movie with Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep. Obviously, Watergate broke a lot of the stories involving President Clinton and his involvement with Monica Lewinsky. So it's hard to say that it's a paper that had strayed from the idea of accountability, but I think it's embraced the notion that that we're essentially in a moment where government isn't providing checks and balances upon itself. And in the absence of that, what's sometimes called the fourth estate, the press, has to step forward and perform that role, and that people will therefore assign it into an adversarial stance when it sees itself performing an accountability role and not an adversarial role. It's not, you know, the Washington Post and Marty Baron, its excellent editor-in-chief, and its journalists aren't the ones standing in the Senate arguing against the president's allies in the Senate. It's providing the country, as well as the people in government, with the information that presumably they need to make good choices. But it's having to, I think, work a little harder to do that in the absence of people in government explicitly trying to provide a check on a very ambitious and very disruptive administration.
Where do you think in all that credibility and trust of the press with the audience comes in, as opposed to what's been described as kind of being in our own echo chambers of only listening at listening to or reading things that support our own viewpoints already?
You know, I do think there are times where the kinds of very tough coverage of Trump combined with a lot of the more hostile news analysis and ideological punditry on cable combines to convince people that the press is simply out to get Trump. And there is a tribalism on cable TV where if you watch some of the opinion shows on MSNBC and just about anything on Fox, but particularly the opinion shows on Fox, you'd think we're living in two different countries with just, you know, different world realities. And I think that affects the degree to which people tune in or believe in what they have to say. I've got to say that there's been a rebound of the belief of trust in the press, but it's been with Democrats and independents who are more likely to be skeptical of the president. And I think the cleavage there between those who are Republicans, conservatives, and Trump supporters and the rest of the country on that reflects a troubling divide. But I think that can't chase away journalists from fulfilling their obligations. I think people need information. And even if they don't want that information at the moment, you know, it also helps provide as best as can be done a historical record for people to go back and trying to figure out, well, what just happened last week, last month, last year, or previously. Maybe I feel differently about that now. Maybe that provides things, sets things up in a better pattern.
Yeah, that historical reference of things is a really good point that you make, that, you know, having all that coverage does place things in time, adds more context for somebody to go back later, perhaps.
Yeah, it could be a paragraph in a story 3 weeks ago, and suddenly with the revelation of new information, suddenly something makes a lot more sense and something takes on a very different cast. And it's worth trying to provide that with our audiences as best we can. But yeah, there is a sense of an echo chamber and of a certain kind of tribalism, people who tune out others on Facebook. They don't want that in their feed because they're providing information from sources they don't trust, or often sources that they don't like because they don't want to hear it right now. I do think that, you know, with social media, we're being flooded with stuff often of widely varying credibility and foundation that is amplified almost without distinction to how credible or how well-grounded the information being provided in. And it is, you know, you can drown in this stuff. And so I don't begrudge people for trying to take some control of the flood of information that comes their ways. I do suggest that people, you know, figure out what sources they find credible and make sure to step outside their comfort zone. One of the key things to me is, let's say you've got a source of information that tends to have a point of view on something or tends to approach things critically towards the president or positively towards the president or any other political actor. Does that news source take into account facts that cut against its theories, its ideology, its rooting interests? You know, is it honest and candid about stuff that cuts the other way? And if it does, I think that, you know, you can say, look, this may be an outfit that has a point of view, but I acknowledge it, I register it, and yet they are trying to be intellectually honest. If they don't, then I think that's a really troubling place to get information, because you can't know what you don't know. Or, you know, I got to say, there are places like Fox and Friends, the morning show on Fox, to which the president routinely turns for inspiration and support. You would have thought it was a Hillary Clinton presidency half the time. They're talking about her candidacy and questions of her emails even to this day. That's just a, you know, it's an incredible distraction from what's happening, whether or not you support or oppose the president.
Just getting on to another major issue that's received a ton of media coverage is sexual harassment, the Me Too movement, et cetera. There's more and more media attention in all aspects from it. Has that eventually or ultimately been helpful on this issue, getting it more light, if you will? Not that it hasn't been an issue in society for years.
Oh, I think the press coverage has led to an astonishing shift in policies, practices, personnel. The question to me is not, is it meaningful, but is it enduring? But I think that you've seen, particularly but not limited to the media, an astonishing series of changes happen. You know, giant figures pushed out of the industry as a result of, let's be clear, as a result of women sharing their stories. And they're the ones who are at times risking their careers and risking their sense of well-being and going back and reliving these things. But also the journalists taking it seriously, following it up, being unrelenting, not doing a one-off story, but saying, you know, how is this being addressed, and holding institutions accountable. You know, it is really with news organizations' coverage that people like Matt Lauer, but particularly Charlie Rose, Mark Halperin, and other media figures, Les Moonves, and certainly perhaps most spectacularly Harvey Weinstein, are no longer around. At Fox News, Roger Ailes was forced out a little over 2 years ago, which in some ways I think foreshadowed all of this, and that was triggered by a lawsuit. But what was interesting was that coverage from at that time New York Magazine, from The Times, from NPR, and a couple other outlets ensured that other issues present would not be ignored, and other lawsuits also forced public pressure on that. I think taken in combination with the past, call it almost exactly a year, in the Harvey Weinstein revelations in The Times and The New Yorker, you've seen a sea change in how seriously this issue is treated. What would have been a punchline in a sitcom a decade or a generation ago is now taken as, you know, a career-ending threat. And I think rightly so when grounded.
Any uncomfortable moments at NPR, given that it also was an issue inside of NPR, you know, with Oreskes and Ashbrook and Garrison Keillor?
Yeah, without drilling too far into details, but nonetheless, it was uncomfortable. I mean, I was the lead reporter, joined by other colleagues, in having to report on Mike Oreskes, who was the senior vice president for news, essentially my editor-in-chief here. Thankfully, over the years, editors and I have developed an incredibly tight protocol for covering such issues that lets me do it with the full independence without any corporate or even news executive interference in the coverage. And it allows for, you know, fairly intensive and at times, as you suggest, uncomfortable reporting. But the nice thing about NPR is that it lives and lived its mission even in its toughest moments of crisis. And I think that's something about which we can be proud. Of course, Garrison Keillor, not part of NPR, part of a different part of the family of public radio. So we didn't have part of that in the same way. And Tom Ashbrook, then with On Point, was actually found by a legal review not to have done things that constituted sexual harassment, but to have done things that constituted bullying, and they decided to force him out. So, you know, I think that the question of bullying, which you've seen more issues raised about lately, has been sort of a sidecar to the Me Too movement.
Well, maybe the coverage of Me Too and all that made it possible to go into those things and raise them for the people who were the victims and realize that, yes, it will get treated seriously.
I think that that's very much the case, that the question of how we are treating people who work with us, you know, journalism is often celebrated, Hollywood often celebrated as these hard-driving industries with incredibly creative forces who should be sort of allowed to be as abusive or allowed to be as entitled as anyone because of what they do and the genius that it requires. And in fact, what we're hearing from people is they want to be treated like human beings. I don't necessarily think that media is all that different from other industries in the country. I think that you could find it in accounting or architecture or aviation as well, and those are just the A's. But I do think that there is something about the celebrity element of journalism, the star power of journalism, particularly television, but not exclusively limited to that, that allowed people to feel they could get away with things because they were, you know, tastemakers for millions.
Let's lighten it up just a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
What do you like to cover? Are there favorite stories you've had or areas of the media that, you know, you particularly like to dig into a little bit more or shed a little more light upon?
Well, so I do a lot of stories on things that go wrong, but I enjoy finding things that go right or areas of promise. I like focusing at times on local journalism. And see what they're up to. I've done stories from Kansas and Alabama. I was recently out in Denver to do a piece about sort of what alumni who had been laid off by the Denver Post were up to out there as that paper has gotten whittled away. And there's a sort of little sad side to that story. But nonetheless, the hope and the enterprise of the dozen or so folks starting up the Colorado Sun, I thought was exciting. You just see these green shoots from places that do interesting things. I think the evolution of BuzzFeed, from a place that was this purely online, you know, viral social media behemoth, to a place that does some really excellent, nuanced, long-form reporting, investigative, political, the whole bailiwick, cultural, has been kind of a sight to see. I've been really interested and taken with that. And there are a lot of different forms journalism takes now because, of course, we're getting it a million different ways. So I've been heartened and impressed to find different ways of doing things. I did a piece some years ago that I really enjoyed about the guy who it was, although he just retired, the top executive at ESPN for interviews. And he used to do just a vicious critique of all these great, great figures in interviewing and TV, Mike Wallace and Larry King and Barbara Walters and Diane Sawyer and all the rest. And he had his way of doing it, and he would just tear them apart. And it was fascinating to see him do it and then to see the ESPN anchors all wrestling with, you know, the combination of wanting to be funny and smart and lively and personalities, and also recognizing that the guy had a point, that in some ways some of that personality interfered with the ability to get interesting insights out of the people they were interviewing. And so there are a lot of fun ways to get into the meat of it. And, of course, just a lot of stuff to cover. You cover the Murdochs of the world. You cover Ailes. You cover the New York Times. You cover a lot of folks on the smaller end as well.
I mean, on the entertainment side of media, what interests you there? Are there things that, while not just being about is this funny or good or creative, but that might have an impact on how we consume or shifts in consumption, et cetera, in the media landscape, like the rise of, say, a Netflix versus, you know, ABC, NBC, CBS?
I think the business, you know, I'm not that interested in reporting on business, but I do it all the time. And the reason I do it is it affects what people see and hear and read. So I've reported a lot on the fight over Fox and Disney and Comcast fighting over its assets and the consolidation, essentially, of what you're seeing of the Hollywood studio system. I've done a lot of reporting also on the streaming services, as you mentioned, Netflix and Amazon, and soon Apple will be in the game. And these guys are taking on the Bay Area, Silicon Valley, and Seattle, taking on the big studios in Hollywood. That's going to affect the nature of what we've seen. The very nature of a TV sitcom has been changed by what you can do on a streaming service where you can watch it at any time and you don't have to sit through ads. Those are two very different models, and it's affecting what you're seeing. It's affecting, you know, it's going to affect what sports are viable down the line by the virtue of what people are willing to pay for and how they're willing to pay for it. So I think that the business of media very much affects what we're going to see and what avenues there are for creative expression. The fact that movies, long the home of seeming the artists in Hollywood, are actually seen as just more blockbuster fare, and that people who want to explore more creative or quirky themes are really gravitating toward what we think of as looking a lot like TV, and actually on the streaming services being, you know, you could say condensed little multi-movies. They're more like the British system where you have these brief flight series that then go away.
Right. Maybe finally to wrap this up, you're coming to an audience event here. When you do speak to an audience one-on-one or you know, in front of an audience, what do you want to get across about your job or the media landscape or informing people how to maybe be critical or have a critical eye on what they're consuming in the media?
Well, so some of this is the subtext. Like sometimes I'll say it out loud, sometimes I won't. I do think that we're living in a time that's a little exhausting. We're asking people to do more to winnow through information than we ever have before. We're asking people to be more aerobic consumers of news. And, you know, the one thing that's nice about NPR and nice about what you guys do there and nice about On Point and other programs is that we're trying to give people the information that they need to equip them to be good citizens, not just simply people who are consuming information in some sort of enormous entertainment stew that may occasionally have something nutritious, but really we want to be lively and engaging and inciting and surprising and delighting. But we also want people to be well-equipped to be in their communities, to be in their country, to be citizens, to make good choices for whatever they want for the future of their lives to be like. And NPR allows you to do that. And what I, you know, want people to be able to do is, as they look out at other sources of information, is to think about those issues for themselves. Is this source of information helping me? Is it furthering my understanding? Is it stoking my curiosity? Is it challenging my assumptions? Or is it just providing me with what I already basically know and playing to my pre-existing hopes and fears?
Well, David Folkenflik, NPR media correspondent and host of On Point, thanks for your time today, and we're looking forward to your visit.
You bet. I'm delighted to be coming up there.
David Folkenflik appears at Syracuse University for a lecture and discussion Monday, October 15th. He's the guest of WAER and the Newhouse School of Public Communications. More information on the event is on our website, waer.org.